right, welcome to Bondcast, James Bondcast, the only show that dedicates itself to the critical and comical dissection of every movie in Ian Fleming's 007 film series once a month for 24 consecutive months, where we will be discussing one James Bond film per month in chronological order leading up to the eventual release of the 25th entry in the James Bond series, which as of this recording is still unnamed. My name is Matt McGregor, and today's episode will be focused on Diamonds Are Forever.
Diamonds are forever.
This is the seventh entry in the 007 series featuring the return of Sean Connery. That's right. He's back. Did we ask for him? I don't know. I'm, of course, joined by my two Bond-obsessed co-hosts, Harris McCabe.
I'm back, and I am so much older than I was the last time you saw me.
Yes. And Colin Shaw.
I'm back, and I'm the same age. Wow.
All right.
In year numbers.
Gone. Great.
You really carry this show. With your wit.
Well, there was a time when things happened and many things were talked about and there was a place and there were feelings and people felt them and
stuff, etc. Let's just jump right in.
Let's go to talking
this
about
movie
James
is
Bond.
Long and convoluted, and yeah, we need to hit it hard.
The plot is a mess.
It's fantastic, though.
We're not going to talk through the plot of this one. We're going to bounce around
a lot. All right, Harris, gun barrel sequence, go.
We're back to the wobbly Connery. We actually haven't re-recorded Connery. It is Connery again, but it's back to his normal thing where he does a little thing and then he wobbles at the end a little bit.
He's got a little
What do you
waggle.
Think of Sean Connery being back? How do you guys feel?
Awesome.
It's awesome, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I know Colin was a big fan of George Lazenby.
I was not. Yeah.
But the rest of us are probably happy to have Connery back.
You Only Live Twice.
Hell.
Yeah, he is much older. When we talked about You Only Live Twice, we talked about he didn't want to be doing it anymore. And this time he does actually want to be doing it. Maybe not, you know, as much as the first time or whatever. But
I'm curious. I'm sure you have the history, but like, why did he famously after You Only Live Twice, he was so done. He didn't want to come back. He felt he was almost offended by the way the Japanese people treated him. You know, I'm very surprised that he came back for this movie.
I think, well, a big part of the reason he walked away from it was it wasn't that he was offended. It was that he was like one of the biggest stars in the world.
They were like photographing him on the toilet.
He couldn't go anywhere. He was his personal life didn't exist. And honestly, he's notorious for being kind of a prickly pear. Like he's a private person, but he's also just kind of a curmudgeonly kind of guy, and he always was. Mm-hmm. And he was never like. He was the kind of guy, we talked a little bit last time about how George Lazenby showed up with long hair and a beard. Well, Connery liked to like wear sandals and relaxed clothing and shit like that. And to be Bond, he was expected to be Bond 24/7, and he was sick of it. I suspect that in a couple of years off between You Only Live Twice and now, he realized that that being James Bond was like a better gig than what he was getting offered otherwise.
He's still
I have a feeling he
getting
at his,
paid quite a bit.
I'm sure it was
he
money.
Looked at his bank account and was just like, maybe being one of the biggest stars in the world isn't a bad thing if I get to do this. He also might have been looking in the mirror and realizing, like, between the last movie and this one, and also with Lazenby looking and being so much younger than him, he couldn't do this forever.
I'm sure he felt threatened by the new guy that they brought in.
A very young new guy, and he's looking older. He looks like James Bond's grandpa in this.
Oh, jeez.
He's still got, but he's, I mean, and think about it, he did Never Say Never Again later than this, where he really looks old, where he was like really balding and wasn't wearing wearing a definitely different rug.
Harris, that's non-canon. We can't speak of that.
I know. That's we're saving that for a bonus episode.
I've seen it.
But he still makes it look easy. He slips right back into the role and just, he's like, oh yeah, so you had some other guy filling in for me? Let me show you how it's done again. But you know, time is undefeated, you know, like Sean Connery is aging here and it shows.
Yeah, well, I think the telling sign is that he came back for this one movie and then never came back again. You know, they had to get a new Bond yet again. And I think right there, knowing that George Lazenby was offered a 7-movie contract, they must have offered the same thing to Sean Connery or something similar.
You think so? Because at his age, I have a feeling
why
they
would
all
they
saw
just
the
want him to
road.
Come back
because,
for one movie?
Well, because that
a
would
stopgap solution, so they don't have to make a decision.
The 7-picture deal intimidated Lazenby, though,
Connery.
No, it intimidated that we talked about in the last one that they offered him a 7-picture deal, and he turned it down. But I mean, that's a huge contract.
That's a big
part
of it.
Well, because eventually that contract goes to Roger Moore. He did seven movies.
Well, right. But it's a big part of a young man's life where Roger Moore, when Roger Moore signed up, he was already very old.
They were clearly pissed about Sean Connery like wanting to leave.
But if they offered someone a contract that was too big, they probably didn't want to do that again. Even, you know, despite everything else. It's like, that didn't work for us.
I have to say, I doubt Connery got offered that contract just because of his age. I think they saw that he was already probably aging out of the part. They realized they were going to have to transition.
My point, though, is that it's silly to bring him back again only to lose him. It's just confusing.
Is it when you don't like the guy you've got and you know you've got a good one who's still young enough to play the part?
Do you really
think
there's a lot of silly things about this movie?
Yeah, that's the main one. This movie's very silly.
Silly on
casting
many levels.
It's awesome.
What do we think of the cold open? We have basically the cold open. So in the last movie, on Her Majesty's Secret Service, James Bond gets married.
Correct.
And then at the end, his wife is assassinated by Ernst Stavro Blofeld. And we open this,
which all comes back in this movie, right?
We open this movie.
No.
Marriage. We know he's chasing down Blofeld.
We don't know anything about the
because he's real mad.
Yeah, we open the movie and Bond is hunting this guy who killed his wife. We literally open with a guy flying through. We're in Japan, and a guy's flying through the wall of a Japanese house.
But if you remember, the last time we saw Sean Connery was in a Japanese land. So are they trying to erase the previous movie?
No, they're not at all.
They're sitting on the fence.
We don't know why he's enraged. He doesn't say it's anything having to do with the dead wife.
Blofeld was in the last one that he was in
also. But he was
also
in You Only Live Twice.
Right, and all they do is say that he's enraged. Thoroughly enraged with Blofeld.
But
they're sitting on the fence.
We
know he would be mad about
maybe
that.
They're leaving
but we know he can be mad about this also.
Why not
mention it?
Well,
it's a different actor?
I would argue that it probably maybe they were leaving it a little open ended.
Maybe
but
they didn't
want to
break the fourth
I think
wall
they
again.
Were, yeah, maybe
stupid.
They don't want to break the fourth wall again. But I think they were making it very clear. It should be pointed out that he was in Japan in the last one that Connery was in, right? Yeah. This opens in Japan, but then it immediately goes to a bunch of other places. He goes to a casino where there's a corny hit me gag,
do you not think that maybe one of the reasons that they did that was to almost tell audiences, like, forget that last one that you saw. This is a continuation of You Only Live Twice. We're starting him in Japan.
I would be more amenable to that interpretation if the last one was a failure. Audiences didn't have a problem with George Lazenby. That movie made money. People enjoyed it.
It didn't make as much as You Only Live
Twice. No, it didn't
make
it.
But then the question is...
That could be for a lot of reasons. It could be because it wasn't as good a movie.
Yes.
But then the question is, why not address the cliffhanger ending of the previous movie?
But they do. They literally open this movie with him hunting Blofeld, searching for revenge. They don't explicitly say that it's for revenge for killing his wife. But you have to say that in the last movie, he had a hard-on for Blofeld in general, just because he was like, this is the guy I really want to kill. But it wasn't like this, where he's like totally off the rails. Like they make it clear, the opening, the cold open is a montage of him rampaging across the world, just basically strong-arming guys, and then finding Blofeld and murdering him in a mud bath at a plastic surgery center where Blofeld's trying to get his... Blofeld is so panicked. Well, we don't know that at this point, but Blofeld is so panicked about Bond murdering him and how Bond is hunting him, that he is at a plastic surgery place trying to change his face to avoid Bond's wrath.
I think we do. He says something about indicating that he's making copies of himself, I think.
Do we see that? I don't think we see that in the cold open.
We see him talk to the scientists, right?
No, it makes sense later, but we don't know any of that in the cold open. All we know is that he's at a plastic surgery center trying to change his face, and then Bond shows up and murders him, which is what he was trying to avoid.
Which, to me, that also covers both. That like covers both the movies,
yeah,
right?
Sure. They don't
because in the other one he has a scar, and then he comes back. He doesn't have a scar.
I don't think
right.
They,
so it implies maybe he's had plastic surgery already.
Yeah, he's done it.
It's funny how he always looks the same almost. Although in this one he's got hair.
That's why I think they wrote it specifically to toe the line. Yeah. They wrote it specifically to sit the fence between it. Like we know he's enraged, and we know Blofeld can change his appearance. Those two things are all we need to know.
I think the
to
point
be able to appreciate
well, that's,
both
that's,
the movies.
That's fine. Yeah. That's fine. My point is they didn't specifically mention that he killed his wife and that's why he's on a rampage. So maybe that's but you can draw your own conclusions. My conclusion is that it's fairly obvious that this is a personal vendetta.
Right, but I think it does toe the line so that people who hated the last movie can say, that movie never happened. Like, this takes place immediately after You Only Live Twice. And then people who like that movie can also think what you're thinking.
Sure.
He's enraged because of his dead wife.
Right.
Sure. Which is kind of smart, I guess, but it seems silly. This
also interesting silly. That the yeah, it's
I think
yeah,
both I think smart it is
and
smart.
Silly. That pretty much sums up this movie. Both smart and silly.
Yeah. But yeah, like yeah, and also like the whole him killing him in the mud bath thing, it's it looks ridiculous.
We should also point out that this Blofeld is played by yet another actor
who was in a previous movie.
Yes, yeah.
So we've had Donald Pleasance and then Telly Savalas both played bald Blofelds, with one of them had a scar, one of them didn't. And this Blofeld is played by the guy who played. You Only Live Twice.
He's the guy who gets stabbed in the back.
Yeah, he's got the guy who gets stabbed in the back in Japan, who is actually an MI6 operative that's working with Bond there. Not a bad Blofeld. I liked him better than Telly Savalas.
Yeah, he was pretty good. I feel like I've seen this guy in something else too.
I think he's good. He works well with the cat.
Yeah, it's good. Some good cat action with this guy. So hey, let's talk about the main titles and song, because after we get our cold open, which wait a second, I just would like to point out, we were talking about this a little bit before. I love this cold open. I thought this was awesome. This was fast paced, globe trotting. It ends up with him murdering Blofeld.
I thought this was dope,
and I was like, Connery's back. Connery's going to Connery.
I like it, but I don't like the mud bath scene, because the action in it is really awkward. Like, it doesn't, and the mud is like, just doesn't, it's it doesn't look like it would actually kill the guy. It looks like he could just swim out. And then also the action in it, I remember, is just super awkward. Like, it's like one of those fights where it's like both of them could have easily killed each other if this was an actual fight to the death.
I wrote nothing about the opening title sequence.
You guys hate this opening. I think this is a great cold.
No,
opening.
I said this was
an A+ because
things.
I feel like there have been some real duds in this.
What
list.
Happens in the title sequence? Refresh my memory.
The title sequence. Well, first of all, it's an underrated song. I think Diamonds Are Forever.
Oh, this is the Silhouettes are wearing diamonds. Right?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. And it's
the Silhouettes are Silhouettes, but the sparkle comes from the diamonds.
It's not in my top five, but it's definitely in my top 10. I think it's definitely better than the On Her Majesty's Secret Service was terrible. This has naked girls and it has cool abstract like visuals. It's
sparkles.
A little. It reminded me a little of like Goldfinger and From Russia with Love and Thunderball. It's got that.
It's got that normal
Bond vibe. So I don't. You know, it's not like a great one, but it's getting back to the traditional ones that we're used to.
The song is memorable.
It's really strong.
It's one of the better songs.
Yeah,
I think
it's a solid song.
Made popular again in modern times by Kanye West. Right.
I thought it was Jay-Z. Oh, yeah.
Was no. Diamonds Are Forever?
Wait, is it?
It's a Kanye. It's Kanye joint.
Yeezy.
Yeah. Yeezy.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
That's blasphemy.
My bad. Apologies to our...
Lord and Savior.
Yeah, apologies to our Christian fans as well as our Yeezy fans out there.
Yeah. So basically, to summarize this plot...
Here we go. I'll check back in an hour.
Yeah, so I know. This is a very convoluted plot. Basically, it has to do with diamond smuggling.
Diamonds.
It's got a lot to do with diamond smuggling initially.
And Vegas. Diamonds in Vegas.
There's a whole Vegas subplot. So basically, it starts off with diamonds are being smuggled and Bond's investigating. He finds.
I think I could describe it like pretty quickly. Like,
you think you can?
After we just read it,
go
okay.
for it. Go for it.
All right. It starts out and Bond.
You're on the clock. I'm going to give you 2 minutes.
Bond kills Blofeld. He thinks, and then he finds out
Spoiler
he needs to
alert.
Investigate diamond smuggling. He goes to meet Tiffany Case. Tiffany Case is like a beautiful woman diamond smuggler, but like. In the mid-level. She's not top tier.
You're never going to make 2 minutes.
Then they team up, but they're still suspicious of each other. They end up sneaking the diamonds into the United States to Los Angeles. They then end up going from there to Las Vegas. They find out that the diamond smuggling ring is somehow attached to Willard White, and they're being chased by two assassins who are super low-key gay. And
Mr. Wint and Mr. Kidd.
And basically, at that point, there's, you know, more confusing stuff. And eventually, we find out that diamonds are being used by Blofeld, who has replaced Mr. Willard White. and locked him in his summer home, and they have made a satellite, which is a diamond-powered space laser, which he uses to then blow up all the nukes in the world so he can auction off nuclear supremacy. And then there's a big showdown.
On an
oil rig.
Oil rig. Wow. That was actually...
That sounds tight. Like, that sounds like a good movie.
Well, first of all, that is a remarkable... You got all the main points in that.
I think
you introduced most of the characters. You did make it under 2 minutes. Yeah. That was actually phenomenal. I am blown away because that is a convoluted, ridiculous
plot. It's super
plot.
Confusing to watch in the movie, too.
Yeah. Oh, it's at no point in this movie did I understand what the hell was going on at all. I enjoyed a lot of the plot twists and stuff like that, but I was baffled by the
entire
thing.
They're in Amsterdam in the very beginning. That's where he meets Tiffany Case, and then through almost the entire rest of it, they're in Vegas or the surrounding desert.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. So we already kind of talked about Blofeld. Let's go through the other villains in the movie. You mentioned Mr. Wint and Mr. Kidd.
Well, there's Willard White, who is not really a villain, but he seems to be a villain for some of it because he seems like he's the guy behind the diamond smuggling. Because
his underboss, Mr. Garrett, or what's that guy's name?
What is his name?
The guy who's the boss of Shady Tree. He's like the casino boss.
Oh yeah, you didn't mention Shady Tree in your little thing, but we'll get into
Shady
him.
Tree's great. The comedy legend Shady Tree.
Yeah, Bert Saxby. Is it Bert Saxby who you're
thinking Saxby.
Of? That's so Bert Saxby is Willard White's underling who does all his dirty business. But Willard White is basically like, he is like a Howard Hughes type.
Yeah.
Of like
he's
this
literally
young,
based on Howard
yeah,
Hughes.
Yeah, he's totally based on Howard Hughes. He's this young, hotshot billionaire casino owner who is reclusive and is hidden away in his casino and nobody's seen him for several years. And that is why Blofeld has kidnapped him and now is impersonating him using his voice. But it's basically, you know...
We don't find that out until the reveal that Blofeld's
behind
all of it.
Yeah, that's a pretty big reveal because Blofeld was killed in the early scenes, and we assume that that's true. But
we just don't see Willard White, and we wonder why Willard White is behind this.
Let's talk about Mr. Wint and Mr. Kidd for a second. Truly weirdo henchmen, real goofballs.
Like, super...
Best haircut.
Oh, the haircuts. Oh, my God. And just the way they talk to each other.
There's one like, scene where after...
What do you mean, Mr. Shaw?
Like the way they look at each other, their tone of voice.
Everything
you can literally see
is,
the vibes between them.
It's like if I was fantasy casting this today, it would be Crispin Glover and Kevin Smith. And I would insist that they were high for every single take.
I remember watching this as a kid with my friend, and he didn't want to remember what their real names were, and he always called them Simon and Garfunkel, and I thought
it was hilarious. which is hilarious. It somehow makes a little bit of sense. And also, there's this. What's the scene where they? Is it the one where they put Bond in the pipe?
Yeah.
At one point, they try to assassinate Bond by just tucking him into a pipe.
Yeah. So after every time they kill someone, they do this little exchange where they like try to impress each other with the way that they're talking about.
Like,
they just
like
did the murder.
Punny, stupid jokes. Yeah. But after one of them, and I think it's when they put Bond into the pipe, as they're walking away, they spontaneously hold hands.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, they do.
That is the strangest. It is like they are, like Colin said before, they are definitely like the first
gay
henchmen
in Bond
movies.
This is what, 1971?
Yeah, it's really ahead of its time. And at one point, I think Mr. Wint says something about, oh, she's very attractive for a woman. And then Mr. Kidd gives him a really dirty look.
Glares
and then
at
he starts,
him.
And then he starts laughing maniacally. like, just kidding.
I'm pretty sure in like 1971 major budget motion picture, that's like as close as you can get to openly gay characters.
So, you know, shame on you, America, because Bond villains had a don't ask, don't tell policy long before we did.
But this is classic of the time, like how they're presenting gays as like villains.
Oh,
you
yes.
know, like
yeah,
they're
also like
giggling.
Just,
you know,
stereotypically
lunatics.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
Oh, they are absurd. And that's even before we get to the last tag on scene, the button on the end of this movie, which we're not even, we'll get to that later. But but yeah, that's
bombastic surprise.
It's amazing. So, and so in addition, okay, so on the villain track, we have Shady Tree, who is in real life Dean Martin's uncle, who did some shows with the Rat Pack and everything.
Which
but
is a great character because it's like a classic Vegas character. He's like this like nightclub comedian who has a really tired act.
Yeah, he's like this old school Vegas comic / mob bagman. It's a very strange dynamic, but it's kind of, it's interesting. It's definitely different than you'd see in a Bond movie normally.
Well, it's like one of those things where, like, you know, we see him tour places, and we get like a stereotype of old Vegas, I feel like.
Right, exactly. Mean? And we also have a thing called Slumber Inc., which is a
Morton
mortuary.
Slumber.
It's a, yeah. It's
Morton
a
Slumber. Run, every run character in this movie has an amazing name. Saxby was the worst one.
The names are terrible. Honestly, Wint and Kid aren't really particularly, because they're not punny enough. Everything else is like Tiffany Case,
but the fact
Bunty
that,
O'Toole.
The fact that they both
Morton
have one syllable names and always call each other Mister. You know what I mean? It's like Mr. This, Mr. That, Mr. This, Mr. That. And that's like literally how they talk to each other. Like,
let's go through all the names. We kind of said most of them just
that. Yeah, Mr. Wint, Mr. Kid, Willard White, which is great because his hotel is
because
called,
alliteration.
Yeah, and his hotel is called
The White
House. White
House, of course.
Shady Tree, which is like, you know, a pun.
Plenty O'Toole.
Plenty O'Toole, which is the woman who's just trolling the casino floor looking for a high roller.
She's basically a hooker.
Yep.
I mean, there's not a lot of
Morton Slumber.
She's almost not a hooker though, but she's basically a hooker.
Yeah. and of course Tiffany Case. Just groan inducing.
Which is,
they're all groan
if you
inducing.
Didn't get it, Tiffany is a jewelry store and Case is the thing they keep diamonds in.
And she's also kind of like a hooker.
She's not like a hooker.
All right.
She is like literally a mid-level diamond smuggler. And she has like a whole operation. She wasn't going to bang. She wasn't there to bang.
That is true. Well, she did, but.
Well, only later after she succumbed to the charm.
There was so much charm, too.
Why are you looking at me like that?
It's
true. Only after she realizes she's going to be spending like quite a bit of time with Bond is she like, well, I guess we're going to like have sex.
This is inevitable. Yeah, whether you like it or not, Sean Connery has his ways. Yeah, no, I think
I do feel like in this one it was kind of like a logic thing. It's like we are going to have to keep hanging out, so.
Well, I thought
let's go ahead and just ask.
I thought Tiffany Case had like, first of all, she's got a good appearance. Like her first appearance, that black dress that she's wearing is really,
she's great.
It's a great looking black dress.
There's something about that first scene. She also switches from like blonde to brunette to redhead in like three different parts.
Yeah,
which is kind of like I don't know.
And also, she's got like the high tech spy gadgets. This is when she's in Amsterdam and she's
and
Bond is posing as a diamond smuggler and she's trying to figure out who he really is. And she's got this little scam where she offers him a drink and then she takes his glass back.
Yeah,
and has like a fingerprint machine,
which does not make sense.
Well, of course, we learn later though that Bond has replaced his fingerprints. Like he plants a fingerprint on there for her to find. So it's
But that's cool. That's like a lot of intrigue. You know, like she's doing her spy stuff. He's doing his spy stuff back. They still don't trust each other, but they start hanging out a lot. And then, you know, they get down eventually.
The Bond girl front, Plenty O'Toole. Just very, she isn't a great actress, but she is.
She nailed the role.
She got a rack.
she has huge jugs. It's not a joke.
That's literally why they hired her.
That is seriously the entire reason of it. And I don't hate it. She didn't have to act that much. She gets killed off pretty quickly.
But this, there is one glaring problem with the film that revolves around her. She is part of the plot. She's the only other woman that Bond is with in any way in this one.
In any meaningful way.
Well, there's girl assassins later.
Yeah, Bambi and Thumper. We forgot about We're talking about crazy names.
The great names.
Bambi and Thumper, the girl assassins who do some sick Gymkata tag teaming.
Yeah, they got like gymnastics fighting.
And Thumper totally hams it up and it's awful, but it's actually a very fun scene.
It's a fun scene. It's all fun.
We are plowing through this movie.
Yeah. Right, right.
This is the best we've ever done.
Okay, so like,
we're like Sean Connery in a harem.
I'm in awe of you guys right now.
We've got to get to the Plenty O'Toole plot hole. So when Plenty O'Toole finds Bond on the casino floor, they go back to his room because he won money on the casino floor and he's interested in taking her back to the room.
And fucking.
At which point we find out there's assassins coming after Bond because everyone's looking for the real diamonds at this point because the real diamonds have been hidden by Bond and the CIA. So the assassins are in there looking for the real diamonds. They throw Plenty O'Toole out of the window and she lands in a pool. And of course the bad guy's like, I didn't know there was a pool down there. And and we don't see her again. in the entire rest of the film. Doing our research, we learned that
there's two deleted scenes,
one in which Plenty O'Toole returns to the hotel room later to find Bond and Tiffany Case together, and then finds the address that Tiffany Case was using while she was in Vegas, which is a huge plot hole because we don't really know as we watch the movie as the actual audience that Tiffany Case has another place, but we do see it later in the film. And
apparently anyone can find it because first Plenty O'Toole finds it, then Bond finds it, and the bad guys clearly found it.
Right, and Plenty O'Toole found it, and they killed her there, thinking Plenty O'Toole was Tiffany Case, which is really confusing when all you see later is that Plenty O'Toole got thrown out of a window, and then later she's dead at a place that we are not really sure where it is.
Yeah, at a other person's apartment that we don't know about. That
and she's dead in a pool when the last time we saw her was she was thrown into a pool.
So it but like it's a different pool.
A different pool in a different place. It's
which
bizarre.
Is really, really confusing.
Yeah. One of a few
and
true
could have been like a lot clearer or at least like had they somewhat
left
clearer
that
had
scene
they left the scene.
In.
Yeah,
and it's like a 1 minute scene.
Yeah, it's nothing. It's like barely any time at all.
I'd like to mention that you talked a little bit about Bond boning in his hotel room. I just want to bring up.
Are you going to the bed, the aquarium bed?
The Lucite, this isn't
that. That's
the
not
Lucite,
the same. That's not the same hotel room.
It's a different hotel room. Yeah. But I just wanted to mention that later Bond bones Tiffany Case in a hotel room,
right?
Where they have a Lucite aquarium bed in the bridal suite.
It's an aquarium in the shape of a bed.
It's an aquarium in the shape
on.
Of the bed. It's got no cushions. It's got no blankets. It's literally just
it's
like
totally
a
rigid.
Hard, Lucite, rigid plastic bed, which seems really impractical unless you think about the cleanup because you can just squeegee that thing off and get the next couple in there.
I was watching this with you and I was talking about this and we were just saying like this is like technically it's a bed, but it's obviously an object made only for like having sex upon.
Yes, just boning all over the place.
I feel like
messily
the 70s
and having no
had
regrets.
A lot of things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
They just made beds like in weird shapes just to have in your house.
Like,
yeah, like that's
where
hey, the water
looks
bed
like
comes
lips.
From.
If this only, one's full yeah, of water. This one's filled with water, but it isn't soft.
Yeah.
If only we could go back to the 70s and get into the furniture game, we would never have to make furniture at all. We'd only have to make objects that you're capable of having sex on top of, and we would be rich as fuck.
This is literally the alpha test of the waterbed. It was like everyone was just like, oh, hey, wouldn't it be better if it was filled with water but soft?
What if
you could actually sleep on it?
What if the water had little fishies in them and you could see it? Oh yeah, how would we do that? That doesn't sound comfortable. Yeah, but you know what you could do on it.
It's bizarre. Also, I would just like to point out that when when Bond is posing as a diamond smuggler, this is something that is one of my favorite lines from the entire movie. He's posing as a diamond smuggler. He murders the actual diamond smuggler, and Tiffany Case goes through the diamond smuggler's wallet, and Bond swaps it out, and she goes, "You just killed James Bond.
You just killed James
Once
Bond."
Once again, the most famous secret agent
yeah.
in the world.
And the great part is the reason she knows is that she pulls out a wallet that is completely empty except for the Playboy Casino Club card.
Right. I have that.
Bond's name on it. His only form of identification.
Another one of my favorite what the fuck moments that came that you wisely avoided in your brief plot description is that when he goes to Blofeld's secret lab where he's creating this diamond satellite,
diamond laser
satellite, Bond eventually stumbles onto a fake moon landing set where they're literally filming a fake moon landing with astronauts running in slow motion
for some reason.
This happens to also be a chase sequence in which Bond steals a moon buggy to drive around the desert.
And if you watch, please watch the sequence because as he goes into he busts into this moon landing set. And there's astronauts pretending they're on the moon, so they're walking in slow motion. And Bond grabs their moon buggy, and they continue
to move in.
They continue chasing him in slow motion as he moves at regular speed.
Like, why are they chasing him in slow motion?
It's amazing.
Like, the scene is over now. We're not filming our fake moon landing anymore. A guy ran on set.
It's fantastic.
Why are you still?
It is so bizarre. It is so funny.
You want to know why? I'll tell you why. Commitment.
Yeah, those, guys damn right.
Those guys were method as hell.
Yes.
There was a young Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah, shout out to those dudes. That is acting right there.
So what do you think, what were some moments that are still kind of like hold up and were really great from this movie that you just think are still rad
all this stuff we just said.
Yeah, we're kind of just rambling through stuff. No structure in this episode.
Well, it's because the plot is very, I think it's very difficult.
I mean, it's so, there's so much.
We got the, I mean, let's talk about the locations.
Vegas.
We spend almost all the time in Vegas.
Okay, the scene where they are being chased by the Las Vegas Sheriff's Department up and down Fremont Street.
Oh, yeah.
That is a really good car chase.
Yeah, that is a great car chase. Like, and also,
for any movie.
At one point.
Really well done.
At one point, that car chase goes into a crowded Las Vegas parking lot.
Yeah.
And it still maintains its intensity, despite the fact that there's like only two ways that everyone can go. And it's like,
well, that's where he does all like the skill moves.
Yeah, there's like some real maneuvering in that. I thought it was kind of awesome. I agree. And I think it's kind of interesting because when this came out, I think Bond was traveling to exotic world locales. But if you think about it, it's not like everybody goes to Vegas. So this could kind of be, you know, not everyone saw this, and we get like views of the old strip, and we get some views of the new strip, and we get a little Las Vegas tour, especially in that chase, which is an amazing chase.
Yeah, as we discussed in the last episode, like a lot of Bond's like globetrotting is basically to promote the place that he goes.
It's exactly what you were talking about. Tourism as an industry is like now thoroughly tied into the James Bond movie, you know, production legacy, I guess.
Even better when you don't have to shoehorn bobsledding and curling into the plot.
Right.
But, like, the Vegas economy, since the beginning, is a tourism economy.
Well, it's funny, too, that, like, when you know, to the layman person, when you think of James Bond, you have that image burned into your head of him playing, like, poker or playing some kind of card game. Yeah, Baccarat.
He's in a tuxedo gambling.
In a casino, right?
Yeah, because casino's a club, so it separates, you know.
But this is the casino of America. This is
the only one where he's in Las Vegas, which is like, you know, famous for that.
Right.
I'd be curious to know how many movies he actually is in a casino, like on a casino floor, you know?
Right.
Well, it depends, because a lot of times they're private casinos, which are different than public casinos, I would say. Mm.
Yeah,
but I don't know.
Well, so the Monte Carlo, and he spends a lot of time in Europe at casinos, where I think there's a lot more of them, and there are a lot more famous, glamorous ones. But yeah, this is his Vegas vacation, and it actually holds up well. This is a fun
trip.
This
is a National Lampoon movie.
Well, at that time, that was like the neon. I don't know. I feel like that was like a.
It was a peak in Las Vegas.
Yeah,
Las Vegas.
Oh, this is like life. This is the part. So it was founded by gangsters. You know, just
in
a,
like the 30s.
But by 1971, some of that like dirty image of the gangsters was overshadowed by like.
This is before the 80s when they sort of like made it a family. Or
yeah, that was.
I think
the
that
90s.
Was actually the 90s. Late 90s. But this was before Vegas got really scuzzy, but after it stopped being really scuzzy, so it was like a little. It was like a heyday where you had like the Rat Pack and it was becoming a glamorous kind of cool place to be, and I think it showed it off really well. Also, we haven't talked about the. Do we know if is Ken Adams back doing our?
I think
production
he is.
Design?
I haven't looked it up,
but
you can
tell you Blofeld's Vegas office.
Well, that's Willard White's office.
Willard White's, but come on.
It's amazing.
And
I love
the oil rig at the end. Like, anytime there's a big, crazy set, you know that.
The best part of the Vegas office is the map of the Willard White Empire underneath the floor of the middle of the room. Do you remember that?
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Because it's like a glass floor, and underneath it has like a map of the world, and then on that map of the world, because it's like what do you call that? When it's like drop like a shadow box or whatever, like it's dropped down so that there's like enough room for three-dimensional objects inside the floor, and those objects are parts of the Willard White Empire, things that he owns around the world. Which comes into the plot when Bond is trying to figure out where Blofeld is. And a classic line for me, because Willard White has like a really thick accent. He's like, he talks like this, you know.
Right.
And
which is how everybody Bond is in like, Texas talks, right?
Right. Yeah. Bond is like looking at the parts of the Willard White Empire, and he's like, so he could be anywhere in here, from here to Baja, California. And Willard White sits up immediately and goes, Baja? I haven't got anything in Baja.
It is an amazing
set. Which makes me laugh every time.
And yeah, the Willard White accent is great. Who is the cowpoke who they got to play Willard White?
His name is Jimmy Dean, like the sausage.
Jimmy Dean, right.
The sausage king.
Yeah. The other great part about that accent is it's part of Blofeld's plan is to take over the Willard White Empire. All he needs to do is emulate his voice because everything's done over the phone. And then they have like the fakest science ever where it's like he literally just talks and it's like, you know, it's ADR replacing him with Willard White's voice. But they act like that's really easy to do with like, what is it? Just like a little coin size thing it drops on the phone.
It's so easy. In fact, yeah. It's so easy. In fact, that Q takes it and reconfigures his own.
Yeah, he says he's going to give it to his daughter for Christmas.
Make it Bert,
right?
Saxby's voice so Bond can fool Blofeld later.
Yeah.
No, the Blofeld layer is pretty cool, and I thought it was a good twist. I mean, I don't know if this got you guys the same way it got me, but I was like, when Blofeld was still alive and he had all these doubles and everything, I was like, oh, I'm sure I've seen this movie before, but I didn't remember that he was impersonating Willard White. Yeah. And so that was kind of a nice, like, I was like, a little surprised by that. And then when the second double walks down the stairs and James Bond is in a room with two Blofelds and he can't figure out which one to kill. The only thing I didn't like about that was that they were both very calm about it. They were like, oh yeah, sure, kill one of us. I feel like one of them would have been a little sweating about it.
Yeah.
You know? Like they probably wouldn't have
been.
Our
lives
so
mean
easy.
Nothing.
Yes, go ahead, kill me. I don't care. There's two of me.
Maybe that's because there's more Blofelds.
Yeah, tons more Blofelds. Maybe that was the maybe that was the plan.
Oh, the couches in there are so good too.
The couches. Sorry, I don't even remember the couches.
The couches around the big map in the floor. Blofeld sitting on one when he kills the Blofeld. When he kills the wrong Blofeld, and then later, Willard White's all sprawled out on it. And also, like, it's so funny when you see the guy playing Blofeld talk in the Willard White voice.
Yeah.
Because he like makes a face and everything. It's like, what is that part of the technology? Like, you know what
I
mean?
So I thought of a good topic to talk about. So we keep mentioning Blofeld. We said his name a bunch of times, but I think this movie culminates as like the end of the Blofeld era.
The original,
right?
Blofeld era. They started.
It's true. Yeah,
they started.
I mean, he pops up again once or twice later on, but not in any meaningful way.
Yeah.
Right.
This is the last big Blofeld movie for quite a while.
And there was some sort of legal controversy going on behind the scenes, right? Like, I don't know exactly what the story is, but there's something having to do with rights. Somebody bought rights to Blofeld or something and owned that character.
I read about that, but it's been a long time.
Yeah, me too. But that's why
the rights were disputed, so they...
They were unable to use him, yep, until just recently.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it is.
But I mean, do you guys like this sort of, and Spectre too? Do they? And I think they lose
like
all mention
sort
of Spectre
went away
after
for a while.
Blofeld is Spectre.
Honestly,
number
I
one,
felt so. Like being too Blofeld focused, I think, limited Bond in a lot of ways. So I didn't mind that this was. I feel like it helped the franchise a little bit, even though, to my recollection, I feel like the movies after this, a lot of them weren't my favorites. But I do feel like it was more interesting to send Bond different places, not just have him fighting. It became, like I said with the last one, the attack on the base, all these things became like sort of cliches, and they were just remaking the same movie over and over again with subtle differences, right. Which it's important to have some of the tropes of James Bond in every movie, but I felt like they were checking boxes, which
it's almost
was
a little
boring.
Like the X-Files. I don't know if you ever watched that show, but they had some episodes that were canon and like followed a longer story.
There was a monster of the week versus the serialized ones.
Exactly. See, and I think Bond after this kind of goes more of the monster of the week.
Which is fun as a change, I think.
Yeah. A new adventure,
though,
new villain.
Hindsight, though, if you could like go back and, you know, somehow control all of this, I would have liked to see, like, you know, every few movies, like, you get both. You know what I mean? Like, every few movies
he
it goes like
up,
monster of the
yeah.
week, and then, like, the next one is, like, very Spectre, and then the next one is maybe not, but maybe has a hint of Spectre.
Well, that's
like What they tried to do with Daniel Craig is like they tried to kind of do that, but they all did tie together to Spectre in the Spectre one.
Who's Daniel Craig? I've never seen
him. Yeah,
what
are you talking about?
I don't know what I'm talking
but what,
about.
Yeah, what you're talking about is sort of like the what television shows have become, because it used to be you had to choose whether you wanted to serialize or whether you wanted to do episodic.
Right.
And now it's like you have like basically the USA Network created, you know, 1,000 shows that were all like, hey, it's a serialized thing where there's an ongoing plot line like Burn Notice or whatever, but then every episode it was, hey, we're doing a new
procedural
plot for this
it's like everybody got so pissed about that Stranger Things episode, which was the only one
Standalone ones you can't even do a bottle episode anymore without everyone freaking out.
That was the worst episode of television.
Any moment. Oh
my God. That was the George Lazenby.
That was the Lazenby of TV episodes.
Anybody got any dumb stuff that you're just like, I mean, besides obviously Kid and Wint's preposterous plan to kill Bond.
Can we please talk about the scene when they actually start using the laser?
Oh, yes, the laser explosion.
Let's get first on. All, this is our favorite part. We watched this movie together. I was wrong in the last episode. We didn't watch Majesty's Secret Service together. I think we watched like the last few minutes together.
Oh, yeah, that's
but we
right.
watched this entire movie together.
Yes.
And it was and quite an experience.
We rewatched one particular scene, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Multiple times.
So the laser somehow... Basically, it's a satellite dish made of diamonds, and when it's in orbit, can be positioned to make a laser that will turn things red until they explode. which is what is done to the nuclear weapons.
Sophisticated VFX.
So basically, you see the laser in outer space, but it's basically a painting. Like
it shoots a beam.
Yeah, and it's a beam comes out of it, which is also just painted on the film. And then you cut to a nuclear missile the first time
in
a silo.
And some animators.
The beam is now gone.
Yeah, the beam's gone. The nuclear missile simply starts glowing red, which is just painted over the top of the film. And then the whole screen goes to like an explosion,
and first,
which is also painted on.
First they kill a rocket in a silo from the U.S.
Right.
And then they kill a Russian sub.
So you see the submarine. The submarine starts to glow red, and then there's an explosion on
the
top of the water.
For the coup de grace,
yes, the best
somewhere
one,
in China,
we see a row of Chinese missiles,
nuclear missiles,
and then to some little guys in a shack next to them in army uniforms. We see all the missiles start to glow red. Cut to one of the guys in the shack.
An extreme close-up of his face.
Runs out on fire.
He starts to glow red. And then there's Chinese guys on fire running around with the glowing red missiles.
Now, this might sound horrific the way Colin's describing it, but I can assure you listeners out there, it's hilarious. It's hilarious.
It is not horrific at all.
Please look it up on YouTube. It's great.
It is one of the funnier moments.
It sounds terrifying, but it looks like...
After watching it, we were like looking around in the deleted scenes and, you know, the special features, and there was a little making of, or a little kind of briefing about these special effects and how they did it.
And this was a technological marvel.
Yeah, they put a lot of work into it. It was kind of endearing to see them like kind of gloating about how good the effect
is. This was so many layers. This was like matte painting and animation and green screen. They were doing it all there to get to, and the result was the most preposterous, hilarious thing you'll ever see.
It's the best part of this movie.
It is the best part of this movie. It's very sad, but it is the best part of this movie.
It reminds me, I remember when we did Goldfinger and we talked about how funny it was when they made all the army guys fall down at once.
Oh, yeah.
it's a lot like that moment where it's like this one special effect is like, it's kind of cool, but it's just hilarious, like, to see.
All right, let's push on, because I think we're probably at a
what are we at
good place with the
Zach, did you watch this movie?
No. Thanks.
So let's talk about gadgets and cars. Anybody got anything? I thought the Tom Cruise style grappling hook in the tux was pretty cool that he uses to scale the outside of the casino.
That was cool. I love the way he rides the top of the elevator on his way up to that, too.
Oh, yeah. That was a nice sequence.
Yeah.
Also, Q has a device that helps him rob slot machines, which is a weird little random throw in there.
This movie is so, like, it's so bad technically and so good for, like, the, like, ridiculousness. You know?
Yeah, I feel like this movie is kind of painting a picture of what James Bond is going to become very soon.
Yes,
yeah.
Which is like an unfortunate, for me, I feel like this is heading in the wrong direction. but it kind of like, in this sense, it still sort of works.
It's awesome.
Well, actually, now that we've reached this point, this is Sean Connery's like final canon Bond movie. He's done six. Are we able to like put them in any sort of order? Forget our ranking system that we did. Let's just sort of off the cuff. Can we just like...
Of the Sean Connerys.
Of the Sean Connerys, yeah.
Oh, well...
I would say Goldfinger. Thunderball.
Oh, no. No, 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 no.
This?
No,
Dr.
No.
No,
no, no, no, no, no, no.
Uh-huh. You Only Live Twice, and then From Russia.
Oh, no, 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 no. I got so many. I got, no, no, no. This is a whole other, I think we could do a whole other hour on just fighting you on this. This is insane. First of all, Goldfinger used to be one of my favorites, but watching it again, it's way too rapey for me to put it at the top. Second, I would like to point out that I loved From Russia with Love. I don't know what you guys are talking about. I thought that was good. Also, You Only Live Twice, I thought was really solid. And do you remember Thunderball? Do you remember those monotonous underwater diving scenes? I can't believe you had that like number two. That's insanity.
I don't know why. Yeah, Thunderball sticks out in my head.
I think Matt Key low-key is into scuba.
I think it's getting kind of high-key now.
I'm a bit of a fanatic for scuba.
He's been scubaing on the weekends, and he appreciates it now. The silence, the peace, the passive, like absorbing the underwater ambiance.
What if this whole podcast is like a ploy for him to get us into scuba?
He just wanted to get us. You didn't have to go through all these, jump through all these hoops. I'm down.
Guys, what are you guys doing this weekend?
Not scuba.
Do you have your license?
Yeah, I don't know. I really, it's hard to put the Connery thing into context.
You got to do it. You can't leave this room until you do it.
I want this one first.
Oh, so yeah. This is funny. This would probably be, I think
this one's up there. It's like, to watch it, it's bad. But in talking about it, it's good.
This is in my top three. This is probably in my top three of the Connery ones. I still really like...
Do you think it's a good send-off?
I think it's a good send-off. Do you want to talk about, we haven't talked at all about the conclusion on the oil rig. Because this is a major hang-up for me.
Effects being so bad?
I thought the practical effects were great. Like guys jumping around and guys bouncing off trampolines.
Helicopters,
that was all really
stuff.
Good.
Yeah, it was cool.
But the helicopters just painted over with red blurs.
Helicopters exploding was not good at all. That was embarrassing. But also the whole plot of the thing where it's like Blofeld's like totally confident. And he's like, oh, they can't hurt me because as long as I have control over this thing, I can blow up anything in the world as long as I have control of a satellite. And then so basically how it ends up is Sean Connery... Or I should say James Bond infiltrates Blofeld's Baja oil rig. Tiffany Case is there. She's pretending to work for Blofeld, but she actually feels...
She's kidnapped.
Well, she's kidnapped. She did pretend to work for him. She pretends she's on his side, which is how she...
No, she just doesn't have any like power to resist.
No, but she uses the fact that Blofeld thinks that she's with him.
Oh, right, yeah.
To help Connery.
Yeah.
And she does that by switching this cassette
tape.
Yeah,
we forgot about this.
This cassette tape.
Another classic thing about this movie. The entire Blofeld plan
navigation
hinges on
system.
Having a cassette tape
like,
to run the
literally,
entire
like
space laser satellite.
Like you would
system.
Have in a Walkman. Yeah. That's what they're using.
It in the case of
which
it's like
this
a
time,
marching band.
Which at this time it's was like very sophisticated technology.
A marching band cassette tape. Like a marching band album.
So
like an album of marching
band. So Connery infiltrates the place with the intention of switching this cassette tape with a different one so that Blofeld can't use the satellite. And then Tiffany Case doesn't realize that Connery has actually been able to switch it, so
she switches it again.
Back to the original one, meaning that Blofeld still has all the control over the satellite, which was his big trump card if anybody tried to attack him.
But then they attack him anyways.
And instead of using a satellite to defend himself like his plan was, he jumps into a midget sub and tries to escape. And Connery grabs the midget sub by a crane and starts bashing it into walls. Yeah. And that is how Blofeld ends up meeting his end in this movie, is being bashed to death.
And
in
we
a
assume
sub.
That he's dead, right?
Yeah, yes. And it's a terrible plan to begin with because like either he had the world by the balls or he didn't. I felt like between the special effects,
maybe the Baja oil rig should have been a little more secret.
I feel like this is like the third or fourth movie in a row, or maybe three out of four, that the movie was whatever, but then the finale.
It's like Blofeld's plans are so meant dumb, to culminate in a disaster rather than whatever that's supposed to be.
It is rough, and the shitty special effects did not make it better. Oh, and then after the fact, we get Tiffany Case and James Bond on a cruise, and they think they're safe. And this is my favorite part.
Before we talk about that, I do love the cassette tape exchange scene. James Bond tucks Tiffany Case is in a bikini the whole time. I don't know if you guys would have realized that by now or not.
I think the viewers understand that we're watching a James Bond movie, and if there's a woman involved, she's probably wearing a bikini.
It's a super cute
bikini.
It's like this purple color.
It is a good
looking
bikini.
Yeah, and he tucks the cassette tape into like the butt of her bikini. And it's like a very like kind of. I remember. I don't know how old I was the first time I saw this, but I was like, something about cassette tapes and butts was really.
It was checking all the Collins boxes. If it had been Money Penny, that would have been game over. You just want to turn the thing off. It's like I gotta take a shower.
I feel like Money Penny would use like a record or something.
Yeah, it's a 45.
Yeah. It's one of those wax roll cylinders.
It's a reel to reel.
Yeah. So he tucks his thing into her shorts without any context, and what he's trying to do is get rid of the fake tape so that Blofeld won't realize that the switch has been made. But she thinks that that he's telling her to exchange the tape. So she does it, and she goes to great like risk and does a great job of exchanging this tape. And then when
he
finds,
just calls her a twit.
And then when he finds out she did it, he's like,
You're a twit, you put the wrong one back on. You ruined everything,
you dummy. It's like he gave her no instruction. She took some initiative, and he absolutely does not appreciate it.
Good
at
thing all.
All
he has to do is blow the whole place up. And
yeah,
fuck
good,
around
yeah,
on
good
a
thing
crane.
None of it freaking mattered. Yeah. It was so idiotic. But Matt, can you take us through our final scene with Winton Kidd coming back on the cruise?
Well, you just ruined it. But I mean, we mentioned it before. So they're on the ship, Tiffany Case and Bond. The mission is over. They're at peace, and they're moving on with their lives. And in come the orderlies.
They're on the cruise ship, and here comes Mr. Kidd, Mr. Wint, and Mr. Kidd.
Disguised as waiters.
The room service.
I think
waiters.
We've seen this before.
And one of them's wearing like the little movie. Chef coat. The other one's wearing like the maitre d' tuxedo. And they present them with what I think they call a bombastic surprise,
oh
which is
God.
Like a dessert. It looks like a big cake, but it's obviously just a case for a bomb. And they're calling it a bombastic surprise. And then Bond finds out it's them by asking for a certain kind of wine, and then he knows, like,
he's
you know, he gets
a,
the
he's
tell.
Looking for a claret.
Yeah, he wants a claret.
And the guy says, oh, I'm sorry, we don't have any of those. And he's like, this is a claret.
Yeah, no, he asked for some kind of wine, and then he's like, oh, I'd like a claret, and a claret is a type of that wine. And then Mr. Kidd or whatever doesn't know that, and so the jig is up. But
he strangles the guy who's dressed up as a sommelier with his sommelier wine tasting cord.
Meanwhile, the other one has big skewers to make
shish kebabs.
He comes slowly lumbering over to him.
Slowly lumbering over with flaming shish kebab skewers. The entire sequence takes about 30 to 40 seconds.
He lights them on fire first.
How does he light? He just like splashes them with something, right? And it like lights them up. Is that what it is?
I think so.
It's a process. I just remember it's a process. It's a long process.
No. He lights before he goes at him. He lights them on fire, doesn't he?
Right.
Because it's more intimidating that way.
Right. But
yeah,
then
it's like
how
flambe.
Does he get
it's
lit
like
on fire?
Flambe
oh,
shish
yeah,
kebab.
He sprays the alcohol. On
yeah,
him, so
yeah. That's what I'm saying.
Right. So he,
and then
so
he's instantly like the human torch, and he just jumps off the ship.
And then
he jumps off the ship into the water.
Yeah,
and then
the
last
other
guy, he flips him off.
Tails through
he,
his
he
legs.
Pulls his he pulls his tails of his overcoat through his legs and backflips him off
back-flips
with the bomb
attached
which
somehow.
explodes him
before he hits the ground. Right. Yeah. Or before
it
he hits
is
the water, I mean.
It is hilarious.
It's so funny.
And
then the classic final line, James, how are we going to get those diamonds down? Whatever. She preps it like she's going to ask him something
that.
Like
she's
really
still
important
about that.
She just
those
like
diamonds
you know
up there.
She's a diamond smuggler. She's a little bit into the diamonds.
Are we ready for our 00 scale?
Let's do it.
Okay.
I think Colin went first last time. Yeah,
I'll go first this time. I really dug this movie. It's a lot of fun. There's a lot of silly stuff. I think it's a good send-off, you know, going off on a high note for Sean Connery. I think I'm going to have to give this 6 O's. Six.
Yeah, six.
So what is that? Sextuple?
006.
What do you call it?
006. We're just going 006. We stopped doing the centuple O whatever.
Oh, I thought we were still at the zeros.
Yeah, we just do 006. We've been doing this.
It's obvious. It's obvious it's on a scale of 1 to 10.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Zach is so confused right now.
Yeah, we're trying to make it less obvious.
006.
It's absolutely baffling.
So the best being 0010?
I guess.
Okay. Right?
Yeah. We haven't had a 0010 or a 001 yet. Colin?
I'd say it's 009.
Whoa!
Ooh.
So funny.
Coming in hot. All right.
The plot's really bad, though. It's really poorly, like...
Is that why
the
storytelling, it didn't get a
10? That's why it isn't a 10.
Yeah, the storytelling is not done correctly.
Colin's embracing the cheesiness of this movie.
I had to. I remember as a kid thinking, like, this is easily one of the worst ones. But...
As a kid?
Yeah.
But as an adult, you love it.
I think that is amazing. That's
exactly.
An amazing take.
Exactly. Because as a kid, it was like, you see, the special effects are not good. And the plot doesn't make a lot of sense, and the action is too. The moon buggy chase.
I think James Bond movies.
He's in a moon buggy for no reason.
Early James Bond movies around this time period have plots that like deter children from enjoying them. You just have no idea what the heck's going on
right.
until the end, and you're like, oh, cool.
But
stuff's
when I was young, I wanted like a little bit more of the seriousness. Now I don't. You know what I mean? Like yeah. when I was young, then I was
oh,
like,
do I?
Yeah.
Well, I think
I'm excited to move on to the next level because I think this series is about to get sillier, and I'm curious to hear what we all think
probably
of these
have
movies.
Strong opinions. I thought for this one, Connery was in top form. The plot was complex and interesting and nonsensical at times, but I thought the villains were very unique. Good Bond girls. The finale hurt it for me a lot. And some of the other plot holes and the terrible effects are actually like...
Are we talking about the same movie?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a point at which it's like so bad it's good. But I'm going to go with the 006.
Fair enough.
I'm with you.
I'm in that so bad it's good phase.
Yeah. So License to Watch?
Definitely. This license earned.
I would say this was... And this was one that we watched together. And I would say my recommendation is License to Watch. Watch with friends. And be dazzled by the great moments and laugh at all the really absurd ones. This is a great thing to watch with
other
people.
Pause it, rewind.
This is seriously, this is a fun one to watch with a group.
Yeah.
Just get super baked and just watch this movie.
All right. When will James Bond return, Matt?
James Bond will return in Live and Let Die.
Live and Let Die. Oh, Live and Let Die is so good.
Yeah.
Da da da. 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 All right, say your spiel. You got your script ready?
Script. This is all off the top of my head.
All right.
That's our show. Thanks for listening. If you like the show, please rate us 5 stars on iTunes and give us a shout out on social media. Why don't you? Please subscribe. Get your friends to subscribe and help us spread the word of Bond because that word is law.
Woohoo!
Woo-hoo.
Done. Forever.
Take us out, music. That's it. Peace.
Thank you.